And at the end of this hour, Iraq, it turns out, still has some secrets.
We finally get cut loose from Walter Reed, and the last words they said to us were, "Near, get your Purple Hearts when they come through," and never came through. We heard they were denied.
That's U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Eric Dooling speaking to the New York Times about wounds from the war in Iraq never acknowledged. We were told back in 2003 that the reasons for the U.S. invasion of Iraq was to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction by Saddam Hussein. None were found, and it became a towering crisis of trust between Americans and the intelligence services under President George W. Bush. The actual discovery of WMD in Iraq might have helped restore that trust years ago. Revelations now from a new and major investigation by our partner, the New York Times, are even more disturbing. Times investigator C.J. Chivers has uncovered that there were, in fact, chemical weapons, that at numerous points during the occupation, American and Iraqi forces came into contact with these weapons, some even wounded by chemical weapons troops were neither expecting nor prepared for, and everything was kept secret by the Pentagon. Joining us now, New York Times foreign correspondent C.J. Chivers. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So this is disturbing on so many levels. First, the timing. Second, the treatment of U.S. troops and Iraqi troops, for that matter, and the fact that these weapons apparently are now in control of ISIS, if they exist at all. What do you lay this out for us?
Well, what we found when we started looking at this a long time ago was that, in fact, there were a fairly large number of abandoned chemical weapons in Iraq after the invasion. And these weren't chemical weapons as you would think of chemical weapons, in the sense that they could be used as designed and fired through a artillery tube or multiple rocket launcher. They were old shells and warheads. Many of them had been buried. A lot of them were pitted and crusted, and they pitted and rusted. And they turned up as a feature of what the war became in IEDs and in enemy caches that were being used to make the IEDs. So the troops who were principally responsible for countering these explosive devices and makeshift bombs were now and then over the course of the war, typically while outside on one of the roads or digging through an old stockpile, finding these abandoned chemical weapons and being exposed to them that way.
And you're going to hear now the voice of Andrew Goldman, who's an Army chemical weapons specialist, recounting his making of a discovery just like you describe, C.J. Chivers. Here's Andrew Goldman.
As I'm handing a round up, just the oily, reddish substance just kind of pours out of the round as I'm handing it up to my teammate. And Eric, Sergeant Dooling, said, hold on just a minute, just as a precautionary measure, we already had one scare today where we thought it was Kim. It was already on our mind. So he went to the truck and got some more M8 paper. And when I tested it this time, it was an obvious positive.
What were the wounds that came from contact with this material?
Well, most of these troops were lightly exposed, and they had suffered a mix of inhalation injuries or burns. And the burns tended to cluster on the lower legs or the upper legs and the shins and the hands. And the reason for that is pretty simple. These shells are big. They're about 40 inches long, 90 or 100 pounds. And when they were picking them up to move them, usually not even aware that they were chemical shells, they would roll them over their thigh to brace them to get a good purchase to stand up with them. And in doing that, some of the chemical agent would be pressed against their leg, or they would inhale some of the vapor. And so they suffered shortness of breath, in one case, nasal bleeding and scarring, and then blisters would pop up usually within hours or the next day on their legs or their hands.
Well, the wounds that you describe here are very, very obvious, it would seem, from a medical perspective. But that leads us to the central mystery here. Why was this kept secret? And that's a mystery that's even expressed by a former Army Colonel, Dr. Dave Edmund Lounsbury, who you spoke with as part of this investigation. Let's listen to him.
If the Allies had found weapons of mass destruction, and more to the point, if Americans had been injured by them, it strikes me as though that might be something you would make a big deal about. These patients would have been celebrities in their own right because they were chemical casualties. But there was no such report.
So with C.J. Chivers, how do you reconcile that mystery that persists to this day?
Well, you just pointed to the great sadness here, which is that the story had to be written at all. Had all of this information been released and made public in real time, if there weren't for this mix of habitual and reflexive secrecy, then these troops might have been treated well. Their doctors might have been expecting them and not trying to talk them out of their wounds when they showed up at the aid stations and medical clinics. And this whole investigation that we had to do wouldn't have been necessary. And there's ample precedent of the United States in brief instances being candid about this. If you go back and read the Dulfer report of the Iraq Survey Group, which was released in 2004, it all but predicted this, maybe not at the scale, but certainly laid out that it was happening. But after 2004, there really was no more significant disclosure, and it was kept quiet. And I think it was kept quiet mostly out of the habit. I mean, you're talking about a government that will classify the weather report when it's in a combat theater. And it's an enormous game of keep away with information. And so this information was withheld, not just from me and not just from you, but from other people inside the military who needed it in real time.
And the language you use is even disturbing, that there is precedent for the U.S. to be candid in situations like this. How would you assess, and is there anyone assessing, the tactical value of these weapons now if they are under the control of ISIS?
Well, that's a great question. Look closely at these incidents, and what you see is that the people who were wounded were in very, very close proximity. Essentially, they were handling these weapons. These weapons were not used as designed. Their dispersal features didn't work. They were in improvised bombs. It may be that the people who were using them in many cases didn't even know they had chemical shells and thought they were using another typical high-explosive artillery shell as part of their bomb. And so these are not necessarily especially dangerous. They're shocking. They would have an enormous effect if one of them were to be detonated in, say, a shopping mall in the Middle East. There's no question about that. But you might have more effect if you went into that same shopping mall with conventional weapons and explosives and firearms and did the type of terrorist act that we see, you know, with sort of almost like a sad routine around the world. So these are certainly dangerous weapons, but we should be careful about overstating the danger. Most of the wounds that the troops received in Iraq came from conventional weapons, and conventional weapons are doing a pretty horrible job of tearing apart Iraq to this day.
But it's hard to overstate the irony here in that the 2003 invasion to eradicate weapons of mass destruction by Iraq, in fact, has actually helped to proliferate and disperse them, even on the small scale that you describe. C.J. Chivers, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thanks so much and great work.
Thanks for having me.